Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Later in today's program, author and actor Daniel Beatty was in town on Friday to discuss his new book, Transforming Pain into Power. Beatty grew up in Dayton and writes about his childhood and his drug-addicted father, who spent years moving in and out of jail. Also in the program, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is looking at new ways of partnering with public and private entities as a way to save money. The airbase held a day-long conference on Friday with local businesses to explore those possibilities. It's called the Air Force Community Partnership Initiative, and Colonel Cassie Barlow, commander of the 88th Airbase Wing, says it represents a cultural shift in the way Wright-Patt will work with local businesses and governments, but the move is also driven by economics.
You know, we live in unprecedented times, and it's time to do things in an unprecedented way. And we are no longer in the era of doing things in the status quo.
Wright-Patt says they're ramping up efforts to share services with private businesses and local governments to ease the economic burden for everyone. A major portion of the initiative involves leasing out 5 designated parcels of Wright-Patt's 8,000-acre compound.
Anywhere that we can use, use economy of scale, basically, to fill needs that both of us have. That's a good thing for us. So, for instance, a very simple example, which we're already starting to do with some of our local municipalities, you know, we all need salt in the wintertime. Certainly we can get a better deal if we all go in together and we buy salt together. That's a perfect example of a partnership. We need to train doctors, and Wright State University needs to train doctors. So the fact that we can do that together and get the shared benefits of that, that's another great example. And there's, you know, probably a million other examples that fall into that category where we have shared interests, we have like interests, and we have similar needs. Another one is child development centers, child care centers. You know, there's a need for child care centers off base. There's a need for child care centers on base. And so where we can team together on needs like that and have a benefit for the overall Miami Valley, I think that's a good thing.
Thursday's conference was a brainstorming session on other possibilities, but before any partnerships are agreed to, they'll need to be approved by the Department of Defense. Small businesses around Ohio are struggling to sort out the details of the Affordable Care Act. As WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, it's unclear whether recent delays in the law help or hurt the confusion.
The big Obamacare question for small employers is this: am I required to provide health insurance to my employees or not?
And that question is sort of like that underwear commercial, boxers, briefs, in this case, depends.
Right? That's Paul Tamby with BW Employee Benefits speaking to Dayton area small business owners. And yes, it does depend. Here's the basic rule. Companies with less than 50 full-time employees are exempt. Companies with 50 or more need to provide health coverage for their full-timers or pay fines. But the devil's in the details, and there are a lot of details. Just for example, full-time means an average of 30 hours or more per week, averaged over the month. Kevin Findlay with Space Management, a Dayton cleaning service, says his first challenge is just counting his employees.
When you're operating a business and someone's off sick and then you want someone else to cover, all of a sudden that person who normally works 20, 25 hours is working 40 hours. So, you know, it's a little dicey.
And the timing of the employer mandate recently got pushed back to 2015 for larger companies and now to 2016 for those with 50 to 99 full-time employees. Meanwhile, the online marketplace for small businesses to shop for plans is still not online. Amy Crouch, an employee benefits expert at BW, says this transition is full of bumps as the administration issues rules and sub-rules based on an already complex law.
You get into tax and law and IRS. Hello. That's not always fun. And then, yet on a lot of these items, it's what's it going to mean in the future in terms of a practical perspective. You know, what does it really mean? And that time will tell.
She calls the future of healthcare the new world. But right now, she says, we're still partly living in the old one. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
Springfield's Board of Zoning Appeals voted unanimously this week against approving a conditional use permit to the developers of a proposed state-of-the-art $2.5 million recycling center and solid waste transfer station that was to be located on Springfield's south side. The project was opposed by many residents in the area. Several from the predominantly African-American Southgate neighborhood voiced concerns over how increased traffic, noise, and odor would lower property values. WISO's Wayne Baker was at the Board of Zoning Appeals and talked to people on both sides of the issue.
Dale Henry, who is the president of the Southern Gateway Association and a former city commissioner, says Southgate residents have opposed the project from the beginning because of traffic, noise, and odor concerns they feel would lower the value of their properties. Talk about the 7-0 vote and how you feel, because you presented 900 signatures and you presented a bevy of facts and people.
Well, one of the main considerations they have is whether or not there is organized opposition, and we certainly turned out the night and showed that there was major opposition, and the people on the south side believe consistently that this would be the last thing we need on the south side of Springfield is a trash transfer station. We're exceptionally happy about the turnout tonight and the vote.
You were very organized when you were talking about, it's not that you're against this in Springfield, it was just not a project for the south side.
Exactly. This would be better for a rural area, and we think it would be better on the south side of I-70 out across from the fairgrounds there at the new industrial park, and we just feel as though the people's desires were met tonight. We were satisfied because we felt as though it was a no-brainer for us, and it should have been a no-brainer for those who have a vote in terms of our quality of life. That's what it's all about, is our quality of life.
Kevin Dewey is co-owner of Recycle Clark County LLC, the developers of the proposed recycling center. He says the hearing was fair and it's time to move on.
Testimony presented was very strong and enlightening. As I said before, we don't wish to harm or injure anyone by trying to do something socially responsible and positive. We do need to find a location a little farther away from residential area.
Do you feel like you got a fair hearing tonight?
I believe procedurally it was sound, and it was a little more based on preponderance of evidence as opposed to facts. But I respect the system, and we will certainly continue our quest in a less populated area.
Now, this is definitely a new and emerging business. How hard is it to explain what you do to people that just around the country are just learning about this?
Well, it's a really pretty simple process. The garbage comes in, we process the recyclables out, and the raw waste leaves the facility. The difficulty is in trying to explain that to someone that lives 150 or 200 feet from it. Like I said in a previous interview with you guys, if it was in my backyard, I'd be concerned. I'd want all the information as well. I don't believe that it would harm or injure anyone, but the testimony was there, and the people were really concerned, and it's a lot of work to recycle. It costs a lot of money to establish this business, and at the end of the day, I don't want to think that I've done something socially responsible and good for the community and have the community upset with me.
Clark County still an option, or will you move around somewhere else?
Clark County is an option, but we'd consider going to another county, especially if we could get more support. You know, we want to go where we're supported. We're trying to do something socially responsible. This recycling doesn't make millionaires overnight. It just makes you feel good. If we could pay our bills and feel good about what we're doing, that's when we've reached our goal. But we don't want to do that at anyone else's expense.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Dewey says that he will still consider locating the waste transfer facility in Clark County, but will also look at other areas as well. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next, Politics Ohio.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Governor Kasich is set to give his annual State of the State speech in Medina Monday night, at the same time that a political battle is brewing against his Democratic rival, Ed Fitzgerald. A Quinnipiac poll this week shows that race is tightening. Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler will be covering the speech, and she spoke to me about the issues Kasich likely will talk about in an effort to appeal to Ohio voters.
I wouldn't be surprised to hear him talk about drug addiction and poverty and education. Those are the three areas that I think he feels like he can reach out to uncommitted independent voters. And these are areas where It seems like there's a lot of agreement with both sides in terms of these are problems that something needs to be done about them. The question, of course, is with education, for instance, what exactly is the solution to whatever the problems that you define? And so I would expect him to talk about those things. This is an election year, so he's probably going to be more cautious than he has in the past. We're hearing he's actually working more from a script this time than he ever has before. And so it's going to be a good speech to listen to.
And indeed, it is an election year. Do we see that Kasich is going to be reaching out to Democrats in this speech?
Well, I think anybody who thought that last summer's Quinnipiac poll that said there was a 14-point gap between John Kasich and Ed Fitzgerald, that gap was going to stay, was completely wrong. I think everybody who watches politics in Ohio knows that, at least for the last couple of years, governor's races have been really close. Governor Strickland and now Governor Kasich, they were only 2 points apart. And this is the kind of race I think we should expect this fall. So if indeed that's the case, that the partisans are going to go for their candidates, which we saw in the Quinnipiac poll, then there's about 10% here of voters who are uncommitted, who are independent. And those are the voters that both Fitzgerald and Kasich are going to be chasing. And so that's why I think you're going to see Kasich talk about issues in general that are more moderate. He's not going to talk about the issues that are extremely conservative, because those are the voters who are likely to already be supporting him. It's the voters who haven't committed yet that he's going to really be trying to go after.
That same polling, the Quinnipiac polling, was showing that there was a boost among women for Ed Fitzgerald. Are women part of this undecided vote? And is there any indication that Kasich will be talking about anything that will appeal to women voters?
The women's vote is crucial in Ohio, and I think that's one reason why, for instance, both lieutenant governor candidates are women. I think it's one of the reasons why Ed Fitzgerald selected a woman as his running mate to be able to talk about the issues that a lot of Democrats are still talking about from the 2012 election, the so-called war on women. And so it gives having a woman on both sides of the ticket gives both sides the chance to talk about the issues that they feel speak to women's concerns. And certainly Ed Fitzgerald and the Democrats are going to be talking about the anti-abortion measures that the legislature has put into place. And Republicans are going to talk about the economic issues facing women. So women's vote is absolutely crucial here. Both sides need to bring in women. You're going to hear a lot of talk and a lot of appealing directly to women voters.
And there's been talk, too, of Kasich as a potential candidate for the GOP for the presidential run in 2016. Anything in the state of the state speech that would indicate whether he's setting himself up for that national stage?
I would be very surprised. He might make a joke about it, but that would probably be it. I mean, you know, he's doing the dodge that a lot of governors and senators and other people who are seen as potential presidential material talk about. You know, they'll say, I'm focused on my job right now. I want to be the governor. I want to be whatever office the person currently holds. You know, we've tried for the last 3 years to ask Kasich if he has presidential ambitions, and he keeps dodging the question, never saying no, but never saying that he does, and kind of letting national publications make the speculation. It doesn't work in the favor of the candidate to mention that, yeah, if I get reelected, I might have my eyes somewhere else.
I've been speaking with Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler, who will be anchoring live coverage of the State of the State speech. You can tune in 7 o'clock Monday evening here on WYSO 91.3.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Coming up after the break, actor and author Daniel Beatty.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by contributing listeners. And there's never been a better time to contribute to WYSO than right now. All gifts received before midnight on March 2nd make you eligible to win a pair of season tickets to Victoria Theatre Association's Premier Health Broadway series next year. That's six Broadway shows. You don't have to contribute to be entered, but we hope you will. Donate online, mail in a check, or drop it off in person. Information is at wyso.org. Thank you.
On This American Roots, we follow two giants of jazz, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane, from humble North Carolina beginnings to trials and triumphs in New York City, including conversations with McCoy Tyner, Randy Weston, Pharoah Sanders, and the next generation, T.S. Monk and Ravi Coltrane. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on 91.3 WYSO.
It's just one of those curious things that I've noticed.
I was just wondering what was there before.
This is Why So Curious, and my question is, why so early? Why is the farmer's market over by noon?
Why?
Who, what, when? Is there some part of the Miami Valley's history, people, or economy you've always wondered about? Our series, Why So Curious, wants to know. You ask the questions, Why So reporters explore. Go to WYSO.org to join in by asking your question.
When actor and author Daniel Beatty was growing up in Dayton, he wasn't fully aware that his father was addicted to heroin and in and out of jail because of it. That realization came later in Daniel's childhood, but it didn't stop him from becoming an award-winning actor, author, and educator. Beatty returned to Dayton on Friday night for a public event to discuss his upcoming motivational memoir, Transforming Pain to Power. We spoke to him by phone, and he shared his story about growing up and his message of personal empowerment.
I was born and raised in Dayton, Ohio for 18 years. I'm educated in elementary school and in middle school in Dayton Public Schools, and then went to high school at Miami Valley School. So much of who I am is rooted in my experience being a Daytonian.
Your soon-to-be-released book, Transforming Pain to Power, deals a lot with the circumstances that you were raised under and kind of where it's led you today.
Absolutely. My mother, Shirley McGee, is an extraordinary human being and has been a real force in my life. My father, unfortunately, battled with addiction my entire growing up and has actually been incarcerated 59 times over the course of my life. And the experience of my father's first incarceration when I was 3 is the subject of a poem I wrote called Knock Knock that became a bit of an internet sensation, receiving millions of views, and is also included in Transforming Pain to Power. And it talks about the trauma of abandonment by a parent as a child and also the resulting issues of identity. And that's a large part of what I talk about in the book.
When did you develop that consciousness about what was taking place in your family and the world around you? I'm assuming those memories are some of your earliest.
You know, my father recounted to me when I was actually a student at Yale and was really trying to deal with a lot of pain that I was still having going on inside, an experience of my mother taking me to visit him in prison in Ohio when I was 3 years old, and him being behind the glass and my not understanding why my father could not reach me, I could not reach him, and he could not hold me. And he asked, or basically demanded from my mother at that point, that she never bring me to see him in prison again. So that actually made the abandonment, you know, more long-lasting. As a child, I didn't process the details of what was happening. What I really processed was that I was sad. And I processed that I must have done something wrong. I must be bad because my father would leave me. My father would disappear because, of course, children view the world in terms of their most basic needs. So it became a real healing journey to begin to understand that I was not responsible for my father's choices, and I also did not have to repeat his choices.
Tell me how this affected your adult life and your move into acting and some of the other stuff that you're doing.
Absolutely. I, for a long time, used achievement to mask insecurity. And, you know, I was a public speaker going all throughout Dayton and eventually all of Ohio and the nation, as a small child, trying to be my version of a Dr. King, who became sort of my role model figure in the world. And again, that led me all the way to Yale, but I was very unhappy when I was there because I had some pain that I needed to negotiate. But I had a discovery that when I would have my singing lessons or be in an acting class and we would connect to breath or we would connect to imagination, we would become new characters, that I would feel so liberated, so free, and so happy. And I began to become curious about what about that experience was helping me heal or be greater than the pain that I was experiencing. And I discovered that there is tremendous power in the moment. There's tremendous power in being present to our breath, and there's tremendous power in being able to use our imaginations as well as our empowered words to shift our reality. So that began my journey to really love acting and singing, and to understand that the tools of the actor, of the singer, of the writer are also available to anybody who may have some difficulties in their life that they're trying to work through.
What discoveries did you make while writing Transforming Pain to Power? Did you discover new things as you process this information and put it down on paper?
Absolutely. I've been teaching workshops and, you know, doing motivational speaking in addition to my, you know, career as a playwright and a performer for many years. But what I did not realize when I actually wrote the book is how much every single thing that I've written, even creatively, is rooted in these same concepts of transforming pain to power. So I was writing characters who were fighters dealing with a difficult situation, and sometimes successfully, sometimes not, always fighting to move through those situations. The book is a combination of personal memoir, my poems, some of my characters, and then some of the exercises that I used. And at first, when the opportunity to write the book revealed itself, I didn't think that I should be writing a book. But as I began to write it, I realized that all of my work had been this transforming pain to power.
Tell me about your relationships with your parents today. Is your father still alive?
Both my mother and father are still alive. My mother continues to be my rock. And, you know, just a huge gift in my life, and I'm so grateful for her love and her support and her consistency. My father is still wrestling with addiction, but we are actually going on a journey that begins with my returning home to Dayton and inviting my father to travel with me on this 20-city tour that I'm doing for the book. And my request to him is that he try for the first time in my life to not only become free from his heroin addiction, but also to clarify what story he may have to tell and to give to the world from what his experiences have been. So I'm going to be traveling to these different cities, and as my father is able to keep his commitment first to himself and to me, he's going to journey with me.
You're putting all of this into the book, Transforming Pain to Power, clearly will help others who are going through this situation.
That is certainly my hope. And, you know, we all have pain. It doesn't have to be an incarcerated parent or a parent dealing with addiction. Everybody has difficulty. And I just in my heart want everybody to know that no matter what they may have experienced or may be dealing with now, there are some real basic tools that can be of help.
You'll be appearing at the Omega Baptist Church on Emerson Avenue in Dayton, Friday, February 21st. That's a 7 p.m. event. I'm sure you're expecting a great turnout.
Yes, this coming Friday, February 21st at Omega Baptist Church, the church seats 900 people, and I'm hoping every single seat is filled so that we can have, you know, a really thrilling experience. And again, it is free because I don't want anybody to feel prohibited from coming, but we will have copies of Transforming Pain to Power available for sale. And, you know, again, this is one of 20-plus events I'm doing that people can access on my website, DanielBeatty.com, DanielBeatty.com, and that's Beatty with one T. But I'm most excited about getting to come back to Dayton.
You're going to hook up with some old friends?
You know, I had the most amazing experience. My three closest childhood friends happened to all be in the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area, which, you know, is very, very close and connected. And I just did a production of my play about Paul Ropes and the tallest tree in the forest in D.C., and they reached out to me, and they all came to see the show, and we got to hang out afterwards. So that was a really neat experience, and I'm certain I'll connect with others. Dear friends, when I'm back in Dayton.
I've been speaking with Daniel Beatty, Dayton native. Also, he's an award-winning author, dramatist, actor, educator, and poet. His new book on Penguin Random House is Transforming Pain to Power, Unlock Your Unlimited Potential. Daniel, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Didn't think I knew how to rock and roll. Lord, I got the boogie woogie right down in my very soul. There ain't no need for me to be your flower. Time, but now I'm gonna let you know. I'm gonna keep on rocking, no matter if it fails or slow. Ain't gonna stop until the 25th hour.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm Jerry Kenny. The weather has changed a lot this week, and to help offer some clarity to the living world around us, here's our very own Bill Felker.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of early spring. Today, the 18th day of the year's second month, the sun reaches a declination of almost 12 degrees, the halfway point to equinox. Now, the sun, which took about 60 days to travel to this point, suddenly doubles its speed, entering wet and fertile Pisces and initiating the season of early spring. A six-week period of changeable conditions infiltrated ever so slowly by warmer and warmer temperatures that finally bring the maple trees and early bulbs to bloom. Early spring links the late winter cold with the lushness of April, and it is made up of clusters of color and motion and sound and gatherings of new sprouts and leaves. The benign thaws of early spring tell ducks and killdeer to check out sites for laying eggs. Jenny wrens are making nests, and the milder afternoons call out moths and water striders. The ground temperature often approaches 35 degrees, the point at which earthworms become active again. And soon they'll be crossing roads and sidewalks in the milder rains, telling all the salamanders to mate in the warming slime. Ragwort and dock grow back in the swamps during early spring. Skunk cabbage blossoms. Yellow aconite and white snowdrops and yellow and purple snow crocus bloom, more pussy willows are opening, and the pollen season, which ended with early winter, begins across the south. All that pollen riding north on the warming winds, prophesying honeybees and butterflies and the warblers of May. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of early spring. In the meantime, don't be discouraged if the weather's cold. Early spring is really here.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks again to all our listeners. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.